This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. So today's episode is an absolute awesome one. If you were at the 2024 SCCM Congress, you heard some of the discussion. The 2024 focused update, guidelines on the use of corticosteroids in sepsis, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and community-acquired pneumonia. Well, very lucky, Vice Chair, Mayo Clinic pharmacist, Andrea Nye, joined the podcast, and it's an absolute awesome discussion. And we talk about which guidelines these are updating, how long they've been in the works, what it was like to work with a specific famous panel member in a good way, not a bad way, what that was implying. Most unexpectedly challenging piece of the process. Then, of course, what are these PICO questions the guidelines are focusing on? And going into like the three areas, like we talked about, sepsis, ARDS, and community-acquired pneumonia. And then we end with a very fun corner of or a section working with your spouse. So ends on a high note here with Andrea. Awesome, awesome episode. Reminder, this is coming out Tuesday, March 12th, this episode. Sunday, March 17th, Selection Sunday for the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket. Four regions. We got the 68 teams picked, ranked. The committee has come through, gave their recommendations. This can be an absolute blast. So if you're interested in participating, at Pharmacy to Dose on social media or pharmacytodose.com, you'll be able to download the bracket from there. But it's going to be a whole lot of fun. But speaking of fun, that's what today's episode is. An absolute blast with Andrea, not only hearing her experience, but learning about these guidelines. So let's get going.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And very lucky to be joined by a pharmacist panel member from these 2024 focused update guidelines on the use of corticosteroids in sepsis, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and community-acquired pneumonia. That's Andrea Nye. Now, Andrea is a critical care pharmacist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. You can find her on X at Dre_PharmD. Andrea, welcome. How are things doing up north? Are you all de-thawing? It's like 60s here right now. It's weird in the Midwest.
Things are going great here. It's been 60 degrees the last few days, but it sounds like we're going to be cooling off, and so winter hasn't left us yet.
It's that terrible like phase in the Midwest where it can't pick a temperature. It's like 20 and then 60 and 10. And, you know, it's like one of those, it's almost worse because your body gets adapting to none of them, right? It's just out of all whack. Your house is out of whack. You're like, no, we can't turn the air on yet, right? Like, so all these things. But very excited to have you on, not only to go through your experience on the guide writing panel involvement, definitely going to have a question about interacting with a certain panel member, but then talking about the guidelines themselves, and then ending with a very special segment called Working with Your Spouse. So that's going to be very fun, and we'll end the episode with that. So, Andrew, as we kind of start, right, 2024 focused update is the title of these. So which guideline or guidelines are these actually a focused update for?
Yeah, so this is a focused update of the CRC guideline. So CRC stands for Critical Illness Related Corticosteroid Insufficiency. This guideline was last updated in a two-part series in 2017 and 2018, and included not only how to diagnose CRC, but also provided recommendations on the use of corticosteroids in several conditions that could be complicated by CRC in the critically ill. So we ended up removing the CRC term as part of the guideline title for the focus update because our recommendations apply to all patients with sepsis, ARDS, and CAP, and not just those with CRC.
And I don't know, I just don't enjoy saying CRC for whatever reason. So I'm glad that that term got retired for me. But now, just for perspective for everybody, right? Because you mentioned this is an update to a 2017-2018 guideline. How long have you all been working on this update? You know, when did you get like the first communication about joining the panel?
Yeah, it was around January 2022 when I first received the invitation to be a guideline panelist. But I think the initial work of identifying panelists and the PICO questions began in the fall prior to that. So it was roughly 2 years from panel acceptance to publication, which it felt like a long time. But in the guideline context, it's actually a pretty quick turnaround.
That's exactly what I was going to say. 2 years actually in the scope of trying to look at these in these very different disease states that we'll get to. That's kind of different for normal guidelines. That actually feels like you all worked at a really pretty rapid progressive rate compared to some of the others.
Yeah, I think with these rapid and focused guideline updates, they're kind of seeking out 18-month turnaround time. So yeah, for sure.
So we're kind of mentioning this panel kind of broadly. Who did this panel consist of? Like what range of experts were involved on this update?
Yeah, there's a leadership team, which comprised of two chairs, two vice chairs, two lead clinician methodologists, the method team, and then we had a panel of international experts. So that included both adult and pediatric representation. It had intensivists from a variety of backgrounds like medicine, trauma surgery, neurology, pharmacists, nurses. And then we had two endocrinologists that were recommended by the Endocrine Society who co-sponsored the guideline.
As co-vice chair, I'm assuming you worked closer with some than simply being on the panel. So describe to us how surreal it was working with Dr. Anand, chair of the panel. I think when you think of steroids, he's like the first name. It's him and Maduri is the names you think of. So how surreal was that?
Yeah, it was very surreal. I mean, the first email I received with him and Dr. Pastor CC'd on it asking to participate in the vice chair role is like, is this real life? Am I reading it correctly? But in all seriousness, there's a little bit of imposter syndrome going into things, but it was such an incredible experience to work with him and learn from such a renowned expert in the field and honestly multiple experts in the field on the panel. But he was great. He knew all things corticosteroids that are up and coming and of course had really incredible insight and perspective in our panel discussions.
And from talking with others who have been involved in guideline panels, you know, one of the big things they mention is that these names that you're very aware of that have been so influential in research and things, they're so kind and generous with their time and like their feedback and things. Was that kind of similar to what you experienced here?
Yeah, absolutely. Such a supportive environment, open to everyone's input and discussion. So yeah, that was just very refreshing.
Refreshing. That's the perfect word for it. That's exactly right. So this guideline is a little broader in a sense that it covers multiple disease states looking at a specific treatment rather than looking at a disease state and all of the treatments kind of in that. So did you personally have a specific area or PICO question you focused on, or was everyone on the panel kind of involved with each of the research questions?
I think our approach with the guideline was a little bit more unique in the fact that our awesome methodology team performed the systematic review and analysis and then shared the results with the panel. So this allowed the entire panel to participate in all the discussions for each PICO question with our methodology team guiding us through the evidence to decision framework. So that helped streamline the process and make it more feasible to have that shorter turnaround time that we were targeting.
And so, from what it sounds like, from saying that there had kind of been work being done before people reached out and some of the methodology chairs doing some of the legwork as well, was there any discussion from the panel members as to what areas you were going to look at and focus on, specifically, right, ARDS, CAP, and sepsis like this does? Or was it one where you all voted and kind of came to that decision as a panel?
So the previous iteration had like eight clinical conditions, but included ARDS, CAP, and sepsis. But it was decided by the chairs kind of prior to getting together that these were going to be the three we were going to focus on, just given the availability of evidence. But it was something that we definitely discussed at our first panel meeting and agreed upon before moving forward.
So from beginning to end, this whole process, right? I'm sure you walked in, right? Imposter syndrome, I think all of us would be feeling it. But what was the most unexpectedly challenging piece of this process? What was something that was more difficult than maybe you thought it would be going into this?
Like you mentioned, I mean, there's a big learning process from just the whole guideline process itself and grade methodology. But for me, it was when we were writing the rationale sections, it was so difficult to capture the richness and the depth of the panel discussion in such a concise way, given the word count limitations we had. So I felt like I just wasn't doing it justice and have a newfound appreciation for that skill reading guidelines now.
So, all of us, when you work in a specific unit, you see a specific disease state routinely, right? You're gonna have biases or just anecdotal preferences, right? You know there's no evidence one way or the other, but you like something done this way. We all have that, whether you believe it or not, right? So how were you able to like put those aside to actually like to be as objective as possible for these guidelines where sometimes there's no evidence at all as to what we're doing?
For sure. I mean, corticosteroids is one of those topics that everyone has an opinion on. So I think, putting those preferences aside and coming in with an open mind to the study analysis and the grade methods, and then being open to different perspectives of the panel during the panel discussions made it a lot easier to have a balanced and objective discussion, trying to putting away aside those biases.
So how is authorship decided? Because I want to point out the listeners may or may not have the publication in front of them, but Andrea, our guest, is the second author. So how is that authorship decided?
Yeah, so De Payen, one of the lead clinician methodologists, and I drafted the guidelines. So we shared the authorship role in this setting, and then the lead clinician and methodologist and the co-vice chair followed. The chairs, of course, were senior authors, and then the rest of the panel was included in the middle alphabetically by last name. So everyone on the panel participated in discussions and reviewed the manuscript and voted on recommendations. But De Payen and I took the lead on drafting things. So got the first author role.
That's amazing. Literally, one of our pharmacy friends and peers, Andrea and I, co-wrote these guidelines. That is awesome. Now I have to ask, right? Because you've written other peer-reviewed publications before, right? Kind of quote unquote standard, more medical writing. How is writing a guideline like this different than your typical medical writing, which is already different than normal writing?
It's completely different. I mean, it's a mixture of reporting your transparent methods approach, sharing the data that the decisions were they were based on, but also including that narrative discussion that I mentioned earlier, and then trying to share enough information to provide the rationale for why we made the recommendations we did. But it's definitely different for sure.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi, providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years. Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So just for some perspective for the listeners, let's talk about, I'm going to highlight these five PICO questions that the guidelines discuss, just so before we dive into them, everyone kind of knows we're on the same page as to what we're talking about. So the first question, should corticosteroids be administered to hospitalized patients with sepsis? Followed by, if patients with sepsis are administered corticosteroids, should high dose and short duration or a low dose and a long duration be used? Now then switching to ARDS, should corticosteroids compared with no corticosteroids be used in patients with ARDS? And then following that up, should methylprednisolone be used over other corticosteroids in patients with ARDS? And closing out our five PICO questions, should corticosteroids be administered to hospitalized patients with CAP? So the guidelines start with septic shock, right? We're an ICU podcast. I think we're going to start with septic shock as well. And so what instantly stands out is the wording, right? And the phrasing suggesting their use rather than recommending their use. So why is that?
The verbiage in this case, or the word suggest, stems from the grade guidance for the level of the recommendation, the panel providing as a conditional recommendation. So the level of recommendation considers not only the level of evidence, which was low certainty in this case, and that in combination with the desirable effects, but also includes undesirable effects, patient values, resources, cost effectiveness, you know, acceptability and feasibility of the intervention. So a lot of other considerations as well.
I love that you highlighted the fact that the verbiage, it is important. It is something to pay attention to, but it's not necessarily based on panel opinion per se. It's based on the evidence behind the recommendation and kind of the strength of it in a sense, right? So that's, I like that you highlighted that. And that's also in line, right, with the, this is the same verbiage as used in the 2021 Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines, right? Which also say we suggest. So it makes sense. No huge life-changing studies on steroids and sepsis between these two. So it kind of makes sense those would vibe.
Yep, definitely.
How did the panel ultimately define high-dose corticosteroids? The panel recommends against their use, but it's defined as 400 milligrams per day or greater. And some might ask, why was this dose chosen compared to maybe, say, 300 milligrams, which some of us might consider a high dose now?
This cutoff was used and established in a past Cochrane corticosteroid sepsis meta-analysis back in 2015. So like you mentioned, we classically think of that 200 to 300 milligram per day doses. And that's, you know, mentioned in the guidelines. But we also have to think about this analysis was inclusive of all sepsis studies, which meant some of the ARDS and CAP studies were also included. And that included slightly higher dosing when you're looking at corticosteroid equivalency. So this cutoff essentially excludes the early studies from the 1970s and 80s that used really, really high doses and short durations of steroids. But I do think moving forward, it'd be interesting to look more at contemporary studies and finding a better cutoff.
Any discussion on the use of what feels like the most controversial steroid, fludrocortisone?
Yes, the controversial fludrocortisone. Truthfully, there was not a lot of discussion amongst the panel. Our analysis based off of mineralocorticoid potency didn't show a significant effect on outcomes, and neither did the subgroup analysis based on corticosteroid molecule. So given the information we had from the RCTs and the analysis we performed, there wasn't enough support for providing a specific recommendation on that. We did add a comment in the guideline based off feedback during the review process stating why no specific recommendation was made.
So the panel made a strong recommendation based on moderate certainty regarding administering corticosteroids to those adult patients with severe bacterial CAP. How much did the results from the Cape Cod trial influence this recommendation?
That's a great question. So we did update the entire analysis after Cape Cod was published and actually met again as a panel. So the addition of this study slightly improved the precision of the outcomes, but really didn't have a huge impact on our original point estimates, but it did give the panel a little bit more confidence in the results. So we subsequently upgraded the recommendation to strong based off of the potential benefit, perceived low risk of harm, just still acknowledging some of the limitations and caveats, such as defining severe CAP to begin with.
And any discussion as to why there's no recommendation on the use of a specific corticosteroid? Because this also feels like something where people feel very strongly about which agent we use in which situation.
Yeah, our subgroup analysis looking at corticosteroid molecule suggested a subgroup effect of hydrocortisone impact on mortality, but none of the other outcomes. And that subgroup effect was judged as low and moderate credibility. So, but then when you look at severe CAP guidelines themselves, or sorry, severe CAP studies themselves, the majority used hydrocortisone. And I would say the other steroids aren't as well studied in severe CAP. Maduri's ESCAPE study contributed a substantial portion of the methylprednisolone group and is a little bit of an outlier in terms of regimen and duration. So overall, given the perceived mechanism of benefit and the limitations of the subgroup analysis, no specific corticosteroid was recommended.
We mentioned that the use of steroids can feel kind of polarizing, and I feel like the use of steroids in ARDS is like an even more hyper-focused, polarizing topic or question. And in a previous episode, ARDS Part 2, Steve Lemieux and I highlighted that, like in the ESICM guidelines, corticosteroids aren't even mentioned. You control F, you can't find them. So what is the ultimate recommendation on their use in this 2024 SECM guideline update?
The panel suggests administering corticosteroids to adult critically ill patients with ARDS. So it was a conditional recommendation based off of moderate certainty of evidence, which isn't that different from the previous iteration of the guideline. But we did remove the specification of using methylprednisolone and the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio cutoff of less than 200 based off of our subgroup analyses. However, of course, a majority of the non-COVID ARDS studies use that PDF ratio as part of the AECC ARDS definition or moderate to severe ARDS by Berlin definition.
Was this the most challenging section, or I guess disease state, to gain panel consensus? Or did you feel, just from a bystander, that there was other topics that were a little more, not necessarily polarizing, but people had a little differing of opinions?
Surprisingly, the recommendation achieved 100% approval from 100% of the panel. So while there was a lot of discussion to achieve consensus, we were ultimately able to do so. And I think we did a pretty good job of that across all three disease states, despite the nature of how controversial all three of these disease states are.
One of the things that stands out to me is if we went through and we had a group of, let's say, 10 ICU pharmacists, I think all of us would have strong opinions on some of these things. And you've just highlighted that we bring in the expert of the experts doing all this research. And even, right, Anand has his name on a lot of those studies of fludrocortisone and stuff. And there's no real argument. There's huge consensus. So I actually think this is a highlight of the fact that being objective when making these guidelines and these evidence-based things, putting those ideas aside, is really cool. And it kind of actually was completely surprising to me of, and that probably played a part into how quickly you all were able to turn these around, the high percentage of agreement. I mentioned 100% on steroids and ARDS. I don't think I ever would have guessed that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was surprising, but I think it was a great, and like you said, putting those biases aside allowed us to have those discussions and achieve consensus.
Another thing that the guidelines and the updates are starting to do now is have a section focused on research items, things that we need to prioritize moving in the future, looking into these topics. And the document at the end, it's titled Research Agenda. It has 12 bullet points with topics or questions. But from your perspective, maybe focusing from like a pharmacotherapy pharmacist idea, what are some of the most important ones to highlight for the listeners?
Yeah, there's a lot of important priorities listed there. For me, it comes down to studying more on who's best suited to receive corticosteroids based off of kind of the precision medicine and using the phenotypes and genotypes of people most likely to respond for all of these conditions. And I think in an ideal world, we would have a better idea of which steroid is the best for various conditions and the optimal dosing and duration and timing to optimize outcomes and minimize adverse effects. But this has proven challenging despite over 50 years of research on this topic. So I think, continue to look for that there, but I think also a challenging question to answer.
Yeah, you mentioned challenging question. I'll tell a funny story. So when I interviewed for my PGY2 at Emory for critical care, Craig Coopersmith, who he's one of the director of like the surgical critical care, Emory critical care society, all those things. He was also SECM president at this time, right? And part of the interview, you're sitting down with him for It was probably 20 minutes. It felt like 4 hours. It was so long. He was so intimidating. And one of his last questions was, all right, if I gave you $1 million, like describe the study that you would design, what would you research in critical care? And I said steroids and ARDS only because that was my research study. And I was like, man, I feel like I can actually talk the most about this, right? Like trying to figure out how am I going to get the least amount of questions, follow-up questions here. But I only tell that story to say, that was 10 years ago, and a lot of these same questions still remain. Optimal dose, duration, when to start, what agent. I think phenotypes are definitely going to play a big part. We've highlighted that on some other episodes, and I think once that, the idea, especially in ARDS, maybe even pneumonia too, some of those things, I think we'll have a better picture, hopefully. Now, the other thing about these guidelines, man, the supplementary content is a gold mine. But if you're just looking at it, it might feel a little overwhelming. So what is your favorite piece or table in the supplementary appendix that you might direct the listeners, or just a general like, hey, this section is awesome?
Yeah, section 9 definitely has the most helpful information. It includes the great evidence summary findings tables and the fun force plots for our analysis. My favorite part, being a pharmacist, is each condition has a table that's inclusive of all the different dosing regimens used in each study. And for CAP, how the studies were defined as severe and non-severe, which I think is a great reference to get a quick overview and understanding of the variability in the interventions across all the studies.
Yeah, are you talking about the study characteristics table that kind of lists them? Yeah, it's unbelievable, especially for learners out there. If you want to get an idea of the history, right, it's literally given to you piece by piece here of influential research in these areas, what different dosing regimens we used. And it kind of highlights how, especially when you get past, 10, 15 years, how all over the place we were with dosing. Some of these are, can you imagine being the main pharmacist, like verifying your like 80 milligram continuous infusion methylpred to be able to do like the 1 mg per kg, that kind of thing? Oh, no one would like you. So from beginning to end, what question or area did you have the biggest change in your thoughts or opinion? Because I imagine once you dive through all the things, some of those preconceived notions or biases you may have probably just get proven wrong, or just through your experience, you just believe them less.
I think the corticosteroid use in CAP is the biggest change for me. Steroids in CAP has been controversial for a long time, and honestly, wasn't something I would routinely consider outside of like maybe concomitant septic shock and potentially ARDS prior to this. So I think diving into that a little bit more and through some of these discussions, it's something I'm going to be thinking about a little bit more than I was before.
So, you use the grade criteria to judge study methodology, but you're also, right, not only involved in student resident research, right, RPD. So how do you have to completely change your mindset from using this grade criteria to when you're like listening to a student like patient presentation or something? How are you able to separate the two? Do we need to say, I'm sorry for the first student that you reviewed after you came back from this process?
You definitely get into a certain mindset when you're working with the guidelines. And there was a little bit of that, kind of change in my mindset transitioning between different projects I'm working on. But I think one other thing is that throughout this process, I was navigating parenthood for the first time. And I found myself searching for level of evidence and recommendations for how to raise a child more than anything.
And how did that go?
My parenting hot take is that there's lots of expert opinions, and even if there were guidelines on exactly how to raise a child, the child probably wouldn't follow them.
You know what? I want to petition critical care medicine. That should be a footnote in this. Yeah. Andrew did all this while being like a mother of a like small human being, because that's unbelievable, right? Every day we get shown how moms are superhuman and superheroes. And this is just another one. We're adding you to the list. Now, remind us ultimately, if you could summarize our recommendations for this focused update on steroids and ARDS, CAP, and sepsis, they are what?
The panel suggests administering corticosteroids in adult patients with septic shock, but recommends avoiding the high dose and short duration. We also suggest using corticosteroids in adults with ARDS. And then finally, we recommend the administration of corticosteroids in adult hospitalized patients with severe bacterial CAP. And I think it's worth highlighting that while we kind of sought out to comment on both adults and peds, due to the lack of evidence, we weren't able to make any recommendations related to peds. So all of these recommendations are in relation to adults.
But that's a really good point, that the initial scope was pediatrics, but there just wasn't enough evidence to make a recommendation one way or the other, correct?
Yep, exactly.
All right. And we have arrived to the working with your spouse section. So I have to ask, right, how often do you get asked about working with your husband? Is this something that comes up often in your work, in your practice?
Yeah, I think sometimes people see, you know, both the last names and are like, oh, are they related? But especially the learners, they'll come up to me like, are you Scott's wife? Yes, I'm Scott's wife, because they work with us in various facets now in their training. So yeah, it's really fun to be able to work in the kind of the same realm as him.
So would you say you two are kind of like Jay-Z, Beyonce, Garth, and Trisha, where like you're frequently collaborating, you're working hand in hand on all these different things, or are you maybe more like Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds, very much still in love, but they don't necessarily work directly with each other? What category would you maybe put you and Scott's like working relationship in?
Yeah, well, I think we worked in different ICUs. I think we've collaborated a lot and have a lot of similar opinions on things. So probably in the former, the Jay-Z and Beyonce.
I love that. All right, Queen B, that's exactly right. Now, of course, at the end, have to ask, are there any funny stories with working with him? You two ever prank each other? Like, did someone go into the office and find stapler and a thing of Jell-O? What? Did you guys get to have any fun?
Yeah, so occasionally we would leverage residents to push each other's buttons during topic discussion. So over time, you learn each other's clinical quirks and preferences, like you're kind of alluding to earlier. So for instance, he would tell them to ask, like, oh, I heard everyone should get fludrocortisone for septic shock. And if he knew they were going to steroids and sepsis topic with me, or similarly, I've had them go ask him like, oh man, norepinephrine, I heard, is the only inotrope that should be used in cardiogenic shock. And it's all in good fun. I think, you know, hopefully the learners found it entertaining, or maybe they just thought we were nerds. I'm not sure, but that was kind of fun.
That sounds like Hannah, one of the previous Mayo Clinic. That's got her footprints all over it from my work with her on the literature review series. But that sounds really fun. I mean, that's amazing. I'm telling you, I'm gonna say it so that we put this into reality. We have to have like a spousal challenge between some of our favorite working couple, you and Scott, Chris and Molly Drogi from Cincinnati. We'll think of some others, but we got to get a third, and we're gonna have some sort of like family feud. We're gonna keep working on this, but if I say it, we might put it into actual reality of happening.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, speaking of fun, hard work, my gosh, Andrea, thank you so much for all of this, not only for this incredible stuff on the guidelines, literally while raising a newborn and a toddler, but also coming on the podcast, highlighting these, for myself, the listeners, talking about the process, and of course, with working with Scott. So Andrea, I appreciate it. Listeners, reach out to her at Dre_PharmD, and appreciate you. Again, many, many thanks to Andrea. Reach out to her. Let her know what a great job she did at Dre_PharmD. Remember, March Madness bracket. So at Pharmacy to Dose, T-O to Dose. Be following me on the socials. If you're not, what are we doing anyway? PharmacyToDose.com for the website where you can get the reference list and more. And if you want to send me an email, PharmacyToDose@gmail.com. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters. This is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guest and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACCP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.